Good morning. Yeah, that's good. Hope you all had a lot of hugs this week. Gave a lot of hugs. For those of you who missed us last week, Bill Glass was here encouraging dads in particular, but all of us to express our love and our appreciation and our acceptance of one another and really affirm the love that God has for each of us through the relationships that we have, because everybody needs love. Whether you feel like you need it or whether you don't feel like you need it, God has hardwired into you a need to be loved and a need to be appreciated and a need to connect. But He's also hardwired something else into you, and that is the need to be connected to something bigger than your own self-interests. If you spend any time looking at people, looking at your life, looking at society, a focus on self-interest will always bring out the absolute worst in people. When I'm thinking about what my desires, my needs, my priorities are, the behavior that's exhibited by me is as bad as it gets. When a society thinks that way, when a church begins to think that way, when all the people are interested in their deal, that's when we're at our worst. And you know when we're at our best? We're at our best when we are thinking about something bigger, something more noble, something more significant, something divine. And we're putting our efforts and our energies into something significant, something outside ourselves, something bigger. And that's when our energy and our interest connects with God's energy and God's interests, and we begin to experience something supernatural. Let me just use the term this morning. We begin living a miracle. Living a miracle is very simply this. When I begin to live my life to where my interests, my efforts, my gifting is connected with God's direction, with what God is doing in the world, then I begin to live a miracle. And that's what Nehemiah did. I want you to open your Bibles to Nehemiah. And we're back in our study, and we're coming to chapter 2 this morning. And here's a man who experienced living a miracle. On a day-to-day basis, he was involved in doing something that was a priority to God, and he experienced God's power in a magnificent way. Now, if you'll recall where we are in our study of Nehemiah, Nehemiah comes along, and he's the cupbearer to the king, which means he's connected to royalty. He's in the presence of the king on a regular basis, and the king, Artaxerxes, who is in control of the world, has the power to allow the city of Jerusalem to be rebuilt, the nation of Israel to be reestablished after they had been in captivity. And the people there are in a depressed state. The walls of the city are broken down. The place is in utter disgrace. The name of God in the world is being mocked as someone who can't even sustain his own people. In the midst of that, Nehemiah, when he hears about the condition of the city of Jerusalem, some 800 miles away in Susa, he begins to pray and ask God to allow him to be part of a miracle. In fact, you'll notice in verse 4 of chapter 1, "When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven." And then we have his recorded prayer. Now, the first question that you have to ask and answer, if you really want to understand, am I living a miracle? The first question you have to ask and answer is, are you praying for a miracle? Are you praying for a miracle? Are you praying that God would connect you with a miracle of what He's doing in the world? Because that's where it all begins. And that's what Nehemiah started to do. When he heard of the condition of Jerusalem, he began to pray. And that takes us to chapter 2, starting in verse 1. It says, "In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought for him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before, so the king asked me, 'Why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart.' I was very much afraid. But I said to the king, may the king live forever. Why should my face now look sad when the city where my fathers are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire? The king said to me, what is it you want? Then I prayed to the God of heaven, and I answered the king, if it please the king, if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my fathers are buried so that I can rebuild it. Now, there's a whole lot of stuff going on inside the text here. We're going to just talk about a few things as we look at this. Nehemiah has been praying now, and he's been praying for about 100 days. From Kislev, the month of Kislev, when he got the news and began to pray, to the month of Nisan, where he actually gets to talk to the king, that's about a 3 to 4 month period of time. About 100 days he's been praying regularly that God would do something phenomenal. God would use him in a phenomenal way. Now, he's got a problem. Because he's got two issues that he's got to deal with. The first issue is that King Artaxerxes himself, in Ezra chapter 4, had shut down the work on the wall in Jerusalem. King Artaxerxes is not in favor of this project. In fact, he's already said, I don't want that city rebuilt. So Nehemiah knows that the king is not in a good mood or good favor with this idea. In addition to that, to make a request of a monarch in anything that might offend him puts you in a very vulnerable position. That's why you notice the fear in the text. When he asked, when the king asked him the question in verse 2, why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart. And Nehemiah says, I was very much afraid. The Persian monarchs were so focused on making sure that everybody in their arena always had a smile on their face around the king, that the news was always good, that the custom was that anybody that approached the king would put their right hand over their mouth so as not to defile the king with their breath. You know, the pre-certs days? No tic-tacs back then? Because even breathing in the direction of the monarch was considered defiling. And now, here's a man who has such a sad countenance in the presence of the king that he's fearful for his life. But there's one thing about Nehemiah that should hold true with all who have faith in God. Nehemiah has a higher fear level for the God of heaven and what the God of heaven thinks of him than he does for the king of men. Courage, said Plato, is knowing what to fear, or in this case, who to fear. And so what does he do? I love this. The king asking the question, in verse 4, the king said to me, what is it you want? And notice his immediate response. Then I prayed to the God of heaven, and I answered the king. See, those two concepts are not incompatible. He shoots off the fastest prayer ever prayed. Immediately, he says, God, you open the door. Here it is. Help me. And God answers his prayer. And God is going to give him the opportunity to explain to the king what it is that he's after. Now, let me give you a principle here that goes along with praying for a miracle. And that principle is this, that waiting on God is not wasting time. Waiting on God is not wasting time. Oftentimes we think, pray. How long do I have to pray? This prayer doesn't seem like it's moving me into the action of the miracle. Praying is never wasting time. He's praying every day. In fact, he's even praying in the moment. Are you praying for a miracle? Second question we have to ask and answer is, are you planning for a miracle? Are you planning for a miracle? Now, for those of you in management, studying the life of Nehemiah may be the most helpful management book that you ever study. Because Nehemiah has not just been praying for 100 days, he's also been planning. Look what happens. He tells the king, "If it please the king, if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my fathers are buried so that I can rebuild it." And then the king said, then the king, with the queen sitting beside him, asked me, "How long will your journey take and when will you get back?" It pleased the king to send me, so what did I do? Hadn't thought about that before. That's a great question. Now let me start doing some calculation. It says he set a time. He had already figured out how long this project would take to complete. Goes on to say, "I also said to him, if it pleased the king, may I have letters to the governors of Trans-Euphrates so that they will provide me safe conduct until I arrive in Judah." He's already figured out his communication and security strategy. "Hey, king, I'm going to need letters of authorization for my trip and for the security as I pass through these various areas to let them know that the project that I'm on is from you." He goes on to say, "And may I have a letter to Asaph, keeper of the king's forest, so that he will give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel by the temple and for the city wall and for the residence I will occupy." He's already figured out what resources he needs. He knows the name of the forest keeper so that he's done his research. You know, he got on the internet and figured out what the closest forest was and who the forest keeper was and figured that out. He already has defined the scope of the project. He's going to rebuild the gates around the citadel by the temple. He's going to need timber to rebuild the city gates, and he also needs a place to live. He's already defined the scope of his project. He's been thinking about this. He's been working on his plan. Goes on to say, "So I went to the governors," excuse me, let me drop back to verse 8, "that I may have a letter to Asaph, keeper of the king's forest, so that he will give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel by the temple, for the city wall, and for the residence I will occupy. And because the gracious hand of my God was upon me, the king granted my request. So I went to the governors of the Trans-Euphrates and gave them the king's letters. The king also sent an army official, officers, and cavalry with me. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about this, they were very much disturbed that someone had come to promote the welfare of the Israelites." Just store the opposition part in the back of your mind, because we're going to be coming back to the opposition. Here's the principle. Faith never negates detailed planning. Faith never negates detailed planning. One of the things that just confounds me, when you read the Bible, is to run into people who say, "You know, if we do any planning or any work, we can't be assured that it's truly of God. So we're going to pray and do nothing. And then if something happens, it's all of God and not of us." There's nothing in the Bible to support that concept. God has chosen to work with and through people in the world. He gets glory out of using people. That's what He created the world to do. To be in partnership, working with people. So here, Nehemiah is praying for a miracle. But he's also planning for a miracle. He's personally working on it to see that it comes about. In fact, what's interesting to me is, in the midst of all of this planning, he says the only reason why it's going to come about, the only reason why it happened, is because God's hand is in it. You know what? You pray like crazy and you make your plans. And if you go out and begin to execute your plans, if God's not in them, guess what? It's not going to work. Right? It's not going to work. Praying and planning. Now, one of the things I love about the Bible, and one of the things I love about Hill Country Bible Church, is that we are not here simply for an academic pursuit. This Bible is speaking into our lives. And there's practical application for this. Let me make one practical application for us this morning. 3 years ago, as a church, we made a commitment to get involved with what God was doing to reach the city through the great investment. And we prayed, and we planned, and we committed and pledged to see the financial resources given to expand our facilities, to expand our ministry, to reach more people the gospel of Jesus Christ. And we've been working that plan for 3 years. But a couple of weeks ago at the State of the Church, remember what I shared with you? That over the course of the last 3 years, we'd fallen behind on some of our pledges, and that we were about $6.8 million from finishing the project in May. And if we were going to finish the project in May, it would take a miracle. Well, I challenged y'all to pray for a miracle. But that was the wrong challenge. Now, this morning, I'm going to introduce you to some difference makers. They're going to tell you how God spoke to them to speak to us to put forward a different challenge. Now, remember what a difference maker is. A difference maker is someone who gets the vision. They get it. They understand it. Makes sense to them. But they also own it. They take it personally. And then they live it out. And I'm going to introduce you to the Barons. Michael, Diana, Stephanie, their daughter. I'm going to ask them to share a little bit about what God's been doing with them over the past 3 years. And by the way, they really wanted to be up here really badly, especially Stephanie, right? Mom drags daughter along. God's done some really cool things through this family, and I just want you guys to just share a little bit about where you're at, because I think where you're at is where a lot of us have been. So, jump in there.
Well, first of all, this is a very familiar sight.
The rubble?
Yeah, the rubble. That's a very familiar sight. But I just want to say thank you for your State of the Church message, and that just really spoke to me when you challenged us to pray for a miracle. A miracle that would affect our personal lives, and the great investment, of course, was what hit me the hardest, because, like you said, we went through the prayer process and we started planning in the beginning, but little did I know that the economy was going to have such a great effect on us that beginning in 2003 and into 2004, like the probably third quarter, we were using all of our resources to invest in other things, and we weren't even considering the great investment at that point. We had gotten pretty far behind, and I had convinced myself, and Mike as well, that there's no way. There was no way in the world that we were going to be able to finish our commitment by May of 2005. So I just blew it off and just quit making the great investment a commitment, the priority. And so after hearing your message, it, like anything that takes a period, I mean, there's a breaking down period, and of course that's what I went through, that breaking down period. And that Monday when I went, the next Monday I was looking over the real life application and just answered the question on, you know, what are the highlights, the highs and the lows of your last in 2004. So in going through that, I realized there was just a lot of stuff that we had gone through, and I had emailed Rick with the idea, well, anyway, as I started my attitude, and that's what I needed more than anything was an attitude check and change. And so I thought about the resources that we had, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to commit those resources to the great investment. And, you know, at that point, emailed Rick and asked him, actually told him how much we were behind. You know, my upbringing, I guess, you know, I felt like I had to confess something. So I, you know, mentioned exactly to the, you know, this is what we're behind. And I asked him to pray for the sale of these two houses that we had, these two houses that one of them had been on the market for 6 months, the other one 3 months. And I just was losing hope. And so Rick said, you know, he emailed me back and said, sure, I will, I'll pray for you. And anyway, so in the process, you know, of course, in my email, I'd also mentioned the prayer cards, are actually praying for a miracle. And with all that in mind, I was thinking about all the people that needed the same type of prayer for, you know, just liquidating assets or property, cars, whatever. And so I just said, you know, maybe we need to pray for that kind of miracle for the people in our church. And, you know, of course, he thought that was a good idea and left it at that. But in that week, as I reflected over the 3 years, you know, I realized that God had never, ever broken his promise to us. Never. Last year, around this time, for about 3 months, there we were on the prayer chain. I mean, just things started happening in our life. And you know what? This church, I mean, you were behind us all the way. God was behind us all the way. He provided. He provided us comfort. He gave us peace. And the peace part is something that I can't even explain. When I thought I should have been just at my wit's end, you know, just a nervous wreck, I was just peaceful. And that was totally, purely a God thing. And so, anyway, in thinking about all that, during that week, this is what my life looked like, a broken wall. I mean, I was pretty broken to the point where, I mean, I was so emotional for at least 2 days thinking about how wonderful and how good God was and just all the miracles that he had already done in our life. How could I even think? How could I even think that he wasn't going to, that this miracle of paying off our debt wasn't going to happen? How could I even think that? And so, again, I mean, I was just, I mean, so emotional and just asking God to forgive us that we decided as a family that we would do one thing, and that is.
Well, after that sermon and her prayers, we sold one of our houses within 7 days.
Wow.
And it was a cash deal, and we were paid off in 14 days. So our commitment is that we will pay off our great investment by May of 2005.
Thank you very much. That's awesome. The suggestion that Diana made in her email to us was that we were making a mistake to pray for a miracle. We needed to pray for thousands of miracles. And so based on what the Barons recommended, we're going to challenge you to do that this morning. In fact, if you pull out your eternal perspective, there's a prayer card in your eternal perspective, and we want to pray for you, and we want to pray for one another that God would do incredible things in our personal lives. If you don't have a prayer card, the ushers have some additional eternal perspectives. They're happy to pass those out to you. Just raise your hand. What I want you to do is I want you to take this prayer card. Here's what this prayer card is for. This prayer card is for you to record specifically what kind of miracles you would like to see God do in your life to give you the ability, if you've made a pledge, to complete that pledge. And it may take a real miracle for you. But that you would begin to pray that God would, specifically, what would it take? And, you know, if you want to participate and you haven't committed to this point, what would it take for you to be able to participate? And our goal is that we would pray for a couple thousand miracles in individuals' lives so that everybody could be part of living this miracle. So if you'll take that card, and during the rest of our service, if you'd give some thought to what would you need to have happen in your life to accomplish that and begin to pray, and we're going to turn these in at the end so our staff, our elders, our prayer teams can begin to specifically pray for you that God would do a work, a miracle in your life. That's what we want to do, and that's what Diana recommended. And I just believe that that's a difference maker. Mike and Diana, they want to see God work in their life. Now, let's relate this to the scripture we've been looking at. What did Nehemiah do? Nehemiah prayed that God would use him to do a miracle. And then he began to plan what that would need to look like. We pray that God would use us in the great investment. But simply to pray and say, oh, well, I'll just pray, and, you know, if it happens, it happens. That's not enough. The next step is to begin to plan. What would that look like in my life to be able to see this happen? Very, very specifically with Michael and Diana, they're contractors. They're in the construction and home building business, and to sell a property was a very specific, concrete thing that they began to pray for that God would do in their life. There's another step in the process, and that is, the third question is this. Are you pursuing a miracle? You pray, you plan. The next step is to begin to pursue a miracle. Look at what happens next in the story here with Nehemiah. In verse 11 it says, I went to Jerusalem. So he's got his plan in place. He said, I went to Jerusalem, and after staying there 3 days, I set out during the night with a few men. I had not told anyone what my God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem. There were no mounts with me except the one I was riding on. So he's on his horse. It's at night. It says, by night, I went out through the valley gate toward the jackal well and the dung gate, examining the walls of Jerusalem, which had been broken down, and its gates, which had been destroyed by fire. Then I moved toward the fountain gate and the king's pool. And there was not enough room for my mount to get through, so I went up the valley by night, examining the wall. Finally, I turned back and re-entered through the valley gate. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, because as of yet, I had said nothing to the Jews or the priest or the nobles or the officials or any others who would be doing the work. Now, what's he doing? He's doing the part that all really good manager leaders do. He's figuring out specifically how to pull this off. He leaves his home. He doesn't just pray and plan and send the blueprints on ahead. He leaves his home. He travels 800 miles. When he gets there, this would have taken several months to get there. When he gets there, he lays up for 3 days. I don't know if he's resting or if he's thinking or what he's doing. But then he goes out by night, and before he tells everybody, before he starts his marketing campaign or trying to get other people involved, he does his work. And his work is to go look at that wall. So at night he goes through the city looking at what it would specifically take to get it done, and coming up with a plan so that as a leader manager, when he begins to challenge people to get involved, he's got it all laid out. He's thought through the process. Now, here's where a lot of it breaks down for us in living a miracle. Third principle is this. The practical side of a miracle is just plain work. The practical side of a miracle is just plain work. Now, when we start talking about the miracles that we see God doing in our church and in the world, sooner or later it comes down to people getting their hands dirty. Do you think kids learn the Word of God without having some adults get some stuff on themselves? In our children's ministry? Do you think that we will gather 1,000 students at the University of Texas campus without somebody figuring out how we're going to get a room for them to meet in? That's just work. We sent a team with Hope in the City to Indonesia to help tsunami victims, and they experience miracle after miracle. And you know what? In the process of them being over there, they had to work. It was hard. They had to invest themselves. It was not easy. In fact, I got a note from Ron Parrish, the pastor who accompanied that trip. Let me just share a little bit of it with you because it's so phenomenal. He says, Dear Tim and Hill Country Bible Church, he says, I'm writing you because you played a part in seeing this mission accomplished. There is no way words could express my gratitude for the contributions to this relief fund. And then he says, It seems like a year's worth of experience in just 10 days. Our medical team experienced the gambit of emotions like grief. overloaded hearing the personal stories of several hundred people who had lost everything but their lives. Many had lost numerous family members. We treated their illnesses, wept with them, and prayed for them. Overwhelming gratitude to be serving in an area where relief workers had yet to arrive, to be praying and serving in the name of Jesus where He is not known or worshipped. Pride in our military's role in transporting food, water, supplies, and people like us. U.S. Navy and Marine helicopters were flying 10 sorties to one of all the other nations involved. They said transportation over there was simply find an open area in a fly zone and flag down a Marine helicopter, and that's how you got to the next village, because that's what our guys are doing and our gals are doing over there to help the people in this relief effort. And then he says, finally, amazement. Amazement at the favor God showed us in meeting so many people of influence. The Indonesian vice president, the chief military commander of the region, along with key U.S. military leaders, each expressing to us their gratitude for being there. You know how they got there? You know what they did when they got there? It all involved effort. And if we're going to be part of a miracle, whether it's in your personal ministry, whether it's in giving financially to the great investment, whether it's part of church planning or missions, sooner or later, you got to commit some time and energy. It's going to take work. Because meeting the needs of people, touching the lives of people, getting to the places where the gospel is shared, teaching, discipling, praying, there's a physical component of that. And most of us think that work and effort is reserved for making money and building a life, and don't recognize that we've got to do that for the kingdom of Jesus Christ. Third question, or fourth question is this. Are you persuading others to join the miracle? Are you persuading others to join the miracle? Notice what Nehemiah does. Verse 17, after he's inspected the city, then I said to them, this is to the leaders of the people that are living in the land, then I said to them, you see the trouble we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins and its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace. I told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me and what the king had said to me. Then they replied, let us start rebuilding. So they began this good work. But when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Gershom the Arab heard about it, they mocked and ridiculed us. What is this you're doing? They asked. Are you rebelling against the king? I answered them by saying this. He didn't say I got letters from the king. I answered them by saying, the God of heaven will give us success. This is all about working for God. We, His servants, will start rebuilding, but as for you, you have no share in Jerusalem or any claim to this historic right of it. Just a couple thoughts here as we move along. The first one is, as a great leader, Nehemiah does not come and chastise the people who are living in the land. Hey, how come you guys had to wait till I showed up? What have you been doing? You're living here. Look at this mess. You're not fixing the wall. Well, aren't you glad I'm here? In fact, you'll notice if you look carefully at verse 17, he uses the term we. He uses the term us. He, as a leader, identifies himself with the people and he owns the problem. In addition to that, he doesn't motivate them on the economic benefits of having a well-built wall. What's the motivation? Look at what he says. In verse 18, he tells them, I also told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me and what the king had said to me. And they replied, let us start building, rebuilding. So they began this good work. Just two more thoughts. The Hebrew literally says, let us rise up and rebuild. Anytime you step into a miracle, it's a step up. Anytime you commit your effort to being part of something that's bigger than your self-interest, you're making a step up. In addition to that, That phrase there, it says, so they began this good work, literally. They put their hand to it. They got their hands involved in the good work. That's what this said. So they put their hands in it. What Nehemiah has said is God's great hand has started this thing. And they say, well, if God's hand is in it, then we want our hands in it too. Now that's the perfect picture of living a miracle. To figure out what God's hand is in and get my hands in it too. Practically, realistically involved in what God is doing in the world. And your life will take on the characteristics of living a miracle when your hand and God's hand are joined together in the same effort for the same cause. Final principle, calling people to God's cause is our commission. Nehemiah, it's not enough for Nehemiah to do it. He calls other people to do it. That's what I love about what Michael and Diana did. Like they said, Tim, we need prayer, and everybody else does too. Let us, as a church, pray together. That's a difference maker. Let's do this thing, and let's do it together. Let's live this miracle together. Nehemiah was a man who faced incredible obstacles. You ever wonder what Nehemiah was thinking on that night? When he examined the wall and expressed his motivation, well, maybe it looks something like this.
Oh God, can we do this? Can I do this? Lead these people. It's like they don't even believe in you anymore. It's decimated. And with it, your reputation. My stomach turns at the lies this says about you. It lies about your strength, your faithfulness, your love for your people. It says, you're just a weak God. Every day the people pass by this hill, they see that lie. I've been here only 3 days and I can hardly take it. How can you? Oh God, will there be no one to come forward and defend your name? And when you gave me this vision to come here, I knew it would be hard. And I knew the project would be large, but looking at it now, it's just so much more than I imagined it would be. I've got almost 2 miles of wall to rebuild. And most of it's on the steep side of the valley. I mean, looking at it now, it just seems impossible. No. I'm not going to use that word with you. I know nothing is impossible with you, God. Forgive me. I just don't know where to begin. I won't forget, though, how you were with me when I brought my complaint before the king, and he should have put me to death. But you delivered me. No, you more than delivered me. You provided me a royal escort and gave me full access to his forest. Now, I won't forget how you've been with me, provided for me, lifted me up to get me here. But, oh God, I need your courage now again. The idea that you're just a weak God has sunk deep into the hearts of these people, and I fear that it will also sink into mine, like these foundation stones so long settled in the earth. And the roots that cling to them seem to say that this will never change. But I have a choice to make. And I'm going to trust you. I'm going to trust in what your word says about you, that you are strong, that you are faithful, that you do love your people. And I'm going to trust you with the dream that you gave me when I came here, that once again, you will again be honored in this place. I will trust you, oh God. I will.
Do you trust Him? If you do, put down a specific request on this card so we can start praying for you, for a miracle in your life. I want you to do it right now. Put it down right now. And in just a minute, we'll be dismissed and hand these to the ushers on the way out the door. We're going to begin to pray for you. You don't have to put your name on there. Just put the miracle that you're trusting God to do in your life so that you can be part of seeing a great miracle accomplished as we move together with the hands of God. I'd like to ask our worship team to come up here and lead us in a song of commitment. Continue to write these down. And in just a moment, as we're dismissed, we'll hand these to the ushers on our way out the door.